You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, more than $10 billion in aid money is headed to Syria after yesterday's donor conference here in London. But with peace talks in Geneva stalling, is this effectively an admission of defeat by the international community? Also ahead, when Europe isn't what it seems, thousands of Iraqi migrants head home, seemingly after too many cold, sleepless nights. Plus, we'll look ahead to New Hampshire as the US political circus rolls into town and wonder, after the monumental failure to predict Trump's defeat in Iowa, is anyone even looking at the polls anymore? And later in the show, punctuation panic in France as the circumflex faces the backspace. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House 1801 here in London. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for the Independent newspaper here in London, and Daniela Peled, acting managing editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. A warm welcome both to the programme. After yesterday's donor meeting here in London, the UK Prime Minister emerged to announce the more than $10 billion in aid funds for Syria. Cameron said the money would provide millions there with life-saving food, medical care and shelter. The cash will also go towards creating employment opportunities, education for refugees in neighbouring countries. But despite the breakthrough in desperately needed aid money, it was hard to escape the notion that with stalling peace talks in Geneva in the background, the cash is a step towards a short-term solution to what remains an incredibly long-term problem. Mary, perhaps I'll turn to you first of all. I got this sort of strange feeling that this was something of an admission of defeat in terms of a meaningful political solution by the international community, but this was something they could all get behind and, you know, dish out lots of mutual pacts on the backs. Am I being a jaded cynic?
You are being a jaded cynic, but you may also be right. I think it has to be said that meetings like this one, with very high-level participation, I mean, Angela Merkel came from Germany, John Kerry came, US Secretary of State, lots of people from all over the region at quite a high level. To get those sort of people together, you had to plan it quite a long way in advance. So I think that the juxtaposition of this meeting and the suspension, as it was called, of the Geneva talks may have been completely chance. But I was impressed, or rather less impressed, by the amount raised, because initially they said that they were hoping to raise $9 billion, and they've ended up with $10 billion. And I just got the sense when it was all being presented that somehow I think maybe they hoped that the difference between what they'd projected and what they were actually getting in terms of pledges was going to be much, much more. And I had the sense that this was almost the barest minimum.
Which would be, well, a further sobering news in terms of this. Daniela, it's interesting. We've kind of been here before. We've had other aid donor conferences, call them what you like. And quite frequently, it seems people aren't actually coughing up the money anyway. The percentage is sometimes less than half of what's pledged reaches those that need it. Given there's no guarantees about even managing to get the money, does that make this even more of a sort of, I don't know, empty... Is it, well, could it be an empty gesture? Even?
I don't think it's an empty gesture, but you're absolutely right. People, yeah, the notorious, these kind of fundraisers notoriously don't deliver the full amount. But I think Europe is realising now that it's not just a Middle Eastern problem, it's not a Syrian problem, it's not just a regional problem. And there is no solution at all on the horizon. I mean, the war will come to an end, because all wars come to an end, but not in the near future. And the situation on the ground when that happens is likely to be catastrophic. When we talk, it's a very good, a very important point you made. I mean, we're not talking so much about short-term relief, food, shelter, getting through one more year. But the longer-term impact of this, you know, repeated displacements, a whole generation of children have had their education interrupted or been unable to start at all. And the refugee crisis is seriously destabilising other countries in the region. It's hard to argue with King Abdullah of Jordan. He said to the BBC this week that his country can't cope anymore.
Mary, it is quite, I mean, worrying is an understatement. Where does this end? If we look at these, the sort of this long-term picture, which Daniela's talked about there, is it too soon to look at, you know, are we going to end up with a Russian-backed, you know, Assad state in the northwest and then sort of all hell breaking loose everywhere to the east? What does the longer-term picture look like, or is it just impossible to speculate?
Well, I think so many people I've spoken to have said this war has got a long way to go yet. They don't believe that it's played out. And that's one of the reasons for the scepticism that's so widespread about whether the talks in Geneva can actually bring any solution. Now, I've always been slightly more optimistic than that. Less big as to whether the war has further to go than the fact that now you've got both the Russians and the Americans and most of the regional powers involved in a process. It seems to me the possibility for actually getting somewhere, at least on the humanitarian front, may be less hopeless than seemed. And I think maybe one of the better aspects of the aid conference in London, just to go back to that, was the emphasis, probably plugged in a way by David Cameron as the host, the very strong emphasis on education and schooling and the fact that a lot of the money that was pledged is intended to try to give all the children who are in the refugee camps some sort of formal education, because, of course, as Daniela said, you're looking at a whole generation that could be left without any education at all.
Daniela, it's interesting. Mary alluded there to some of these other actors involved, Russia, the United States, of course. Saudi Arabia is interesting. Sort of noises this week about the consideration of ground troops. Now, could that help in some way, because then they are invested in a different way in the disagreement, or does that further muddy what one thought were unmuddiable further waters?
I'm not sure that the entrance of Saudi Arabian troops on the ground will actually improve the situation.
Well, what would it do? What might it do?
Well, look, the Russian entrance into this was a real game changer. And I'm still not convinced that at some point they're not going to say, right, OK, Mr. Assad, we've had enough. It's time for you to step aside and go into retirement. Perhaps we'll have to wait for that to happen. But what's, I would say, in the short term, I mean, the peace process is fairly, I agree, it's not going to give us any dividends anytime soon. But in a way, the situation is so dire that you need to have a framework that you can build on, deviate from, come back to. I mean, this is a long, long, long way to run. And I can't even say neither side, no side at the moment is at the point where the civil wars only end when one side or one element has got the upper hand, and that's not happening yet.
Just to sort of zero in then on the Russians, Mary, because that is particularly interesting. Jens Stoltenberg said the Russians were undermining the process. Are they actively seeking to do that, or are they attempting to consolidate their own interests? And in fact, does it matter whether you make the distinction about which of those they are doing?
Well, I think probably on the ground, it doesn't make any difference whether you make that distinction or not. I mean, I've had the very strong impression, especially over the last 2-3 weeks, of an enormous degree of spin on both sides, both from the Western side and from the Russian side, as to what each side is actually doing there. And I feel that I don't know whether it's sort of gamesmanship on the eve of the talks or what was going on. But I feel that Stoltenberg and the official NATO attitude and some of what's being said in Britain and America has sort of stood back with a degree of sort of horror and said, the Russians are really messing this up for us, you know, as though if the Russians weren't there, everything would be fine and good. Mm. And that's applied particularly to the latest latest Russian bombing of the outskirts of Aleppo. And yes, that has caused, it appears, streams of refugees to leave Aleppo. But what's being forgotten here, and what, as it were, our side is not saying, Aleppo was not exactly paradise before the Russians went in. And when the Western spokesmen say, this is awful dreadful because what the Russians have done is effectively cut off the rebels' supply route, they're talking about some sections of the rebels, which in their view are, as it were, orientated to the western side. Now, there are villages, it appears, and whole towns that have been under siege in the same way that villages and towns have been under siege by the other side, by the Assad government side. And we have made huge play of how people have been starving and aid packages need to go in. Well, you know, it's not just in those villages, it's also in villages outside Aleppo. And I'm sure that if you were sitting in Moscow, you'd be getting a completely different view of what of the effect of what the Russians were doing.
Someone who is sitting in Moscow is obviously Vladimir Putin. What about that point that Daniela raised about the possibility even of the Russians just saying, look, you know, we've had enough now, time for you to go? Is that, in your view, is that a credible
I think that's entirely outcome? Credible. I think the Russians, and I have thought, and I think Putin is actually on the record, as saying that the Russians are far less interested in shoring up Assad personally than they are in preserving the pillars of the Syrian state. And the problem at the moment is that there is no successor to Assad in even visible on the distant horizon. And for the time being, Assad is all that is actually holding the relics of the Syrian state together. But my view, and I think the Russian priority is not to have a collapse of the sort that there was in Libya, of the sort that there was in Iraq. They want that. I think they're all in favour of a transition. They understand that maybe a transition is inevitable, but they want it to be as orderly as possible and not resulting in the complete breakdown of the state.
In the meantime then, Daniela, what about the leverage that other countries have? We talk about these external actors. The US is one, a counterpoint, a counterbalance, if you like, to Russia. Does the US have any leverage over the Russians? Is there more that could be done, do you think, to try and shape their view of how this happens, at least in the short term?
Well, I think the West has been trying to get leverage over Russia in various arenas for quite a while without any very great obvious effect. Fundamentally, it also comes down to the fact that an authoritarian regime can act according to its own very narrow interests rather than what the wider public wants or deems responsible. Putin doesn't have any those worries particularly of the public's view. And the media in Russia and looking out of Russia is very much behind him. I mean, that's a sort of understatement, really. But I think the West and America, you know, and Europe are looking for ways to influence Russia. But we've been on the back foot all the way for the last several years, and it only seems likely to continue.
Well, let's move on. Some of the images we've been seeing in the news of desperate refugees making their way to Europe via any means possible to escape exactly these sorts of troubles over the last weeks and months. The International Organization for Migration says it helped almost 3,500 Iraqis embark on a return home, though, last year. That represents just a portion of those making the trip. The reasons are often complex, of course. Sometimes residency applications are denied. Some can't cope with the high cost of living. Often would-be refugees simply aren't prepared for the culture shock that Europe and parts of Europe can present. Mary, it struck me as rather interesting that it seems to be quite large numbers, certainly of Iraqis, and frequently returning home from Northern Europe. Does this just demonstrate that the lack of, I guess, mutual understanding from both sides, if you want to call it that, of what's involved when you get migration on this sort of scale?
I think it probably does. I think also it is a reflection of the fact that at least in the parts of Iraq where those particular people are going back to and came from, that they see that they will have weighed up the balance and decided that their prospects look better where they came from than where they went to. And I think there's probably thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of others who will weigh weigh up the balance and decide that actually it's on the other side, that where they've come from is so dreadful that they can't go back. Now, in some ways, this may be useful. It may be useful to the European countries claiming to be overburdened with refugees and would-be migrants, in that in some ways it separates out at least some who maybe wouldn't fall into the refugee category, who would be seeking safety above everything else. But I think what I'd really like to know, and which wasn't explained, you know, the article, I think it was in the New York Times, I would love to know how the people who are going back, how they envisaged the life that they were going to have wherever they fetched up. I mean, why did they make the journey, and what vision did they have that has now been so drastically disappointed?
I mean, it's interesting. I wonder, Daniel, do we almost need to sort of recalibrate our understanding of what, I mean, economic migrant is a term that's been rather sort of taken over, certainly by some sort of populist movements in Europe. But do we need to look again at what that means? Exactly as Mary describes there, the life that these people envisage, you know, when they set out on these often very perilous journeys. Do we need to sort of go back to basics and redefine what we understand by you know, a migrant in that sense?
I think what we often underestimate is the pull of home and how deeply important it is to people. I've spoken to so many people in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq who have gone back because they want to be somewhere where they can feel part of it. Spoken to lots of Iraqis who are talking about, you know, going to America and exploiting what avenues they have. And they were aware, you know, if you're an educated person in Iraq, a doctor, lawyer, lecturer, you can't expect anything close to that level of employment or status if you move away. And people want to be with their families, with their cultural traditions, where they feel part of the country. And given even a slight improvement in a country's fortunes, people will come back to try and rebuild. I mean, Iraq has already suffered a catastrophic displacement of people in the war, and the Iraqi government very much trying to bring people home as well. I think since 2008, they've had a scheme helping former refugees come home. I mean, of course, 50% of the refugees who fled Iraq went to Syria. I mean, there's another aspect of it. So part of the of going back as well is finding where to fit in, and also being able to access services. Your prospects are a little easier if you're an economic migrant and you decide to return. But it's a country that's still in a state of flux.
Just finally on this, Mary, is there a sort of an indelible change happening in certain EU nations in particular because of what's happening at the moment? Obviously, this is a continent that's seen a number of mass migrations in the not too distant past. We're seeing changes maybe in certain of the political rhetoric. We're seeing some changes in terms of policy, in terms of, you know, housing or, you know, socio-political factors. Are things changing in an indelible way, do you think, because of what's happening at the moment?
Well, I'm not sure that they're changing. I think maybe there was what will look, in with hindsight, like a relatively brief period when the milk of human kindness sort of flowed with extraordinary generosity, and that, you know, the mood in Germany, say, was an illustration of this, and that it was seen, as it were, as Europe and the European Union putting its best face on what was happening and saying, look, we're rich countries, we can afford to do that. As, you know, as Angela Merkel said, you know, we can do this. And I think maybe when we look at this with hindsight, we'll say, well, actually, that was the exception. And the rule was that, in fact, the tolerance of the home population for very large movements of people, and in this case, very large movements of, you know, it has to be said, non-Europeans, that the tolerance level has probably been reached. And so, yes, we may be at a turning point, but I think probably the previous year or so has been exceptional.
More from Mary Dzhevsky and from Daniela Peled and from me, Tom Edwards. When we come back on Midori House, we're going to be talking about the Trump factor and what it's done to polling in the United States, amongst other things, after this.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a Monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, my guests today, Mary Dzhevsky and Daniela Peled. Let's look to the United States now, where election fever is having a rather curious impact on voters ahead of primaries in New Hampshire, when Ted Cruz emerged victorious over the favourite Donald Trump and Republican and moderate contender Marco Rubio in Iowa. Observers again began pointing the finger at the pollsters, of all people, in what's become a running theme in this election campaign. It seems once again that expert predictions failed to grasp the mood among voters. As one expert quipped, you could call the same household two nights running and get two entirely different answers. Danielle, I'll come to you first of all. It is interesting that people seem generally, the pollsters I'm talking about, to have, I don't want to accuse them of a collective failing, but they seem to have got worse at predicting these outcomes. Do you think that pollsters need to up their game, or are people becoming more unpredictable?
Well, Mary and I were discussing this earlier. We were trying to remember the last time in any election that the pollsters actually managed to predict anything. And we really were reaching further and further and further back. And it doesn't seem... I think it's a reflection of the sort of wonderfully psychological aspect of democracy, that people are drawn back to predictions and pollsters and results, even though they don't have a great deal... of relevance. I mean, the polls, I think, seem to only have an effect on voters, which has nothing to do with reality. The polls seem to function in a completely separate space, and of course, people don't tell them necessarily the truth. I think people over-report their support for Trump. Which comes as a surprise to me, because I would imagine that you would be a bit embarrassed to say that. But then that's me as a sort of left-wing North London liberal.
Mary, it's an interesting point, though. If people are prone to misrepresent their intentions or indeed misreport their actual voting, then, I don't know, does that spell the end of the game then for pollsters almost?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you do sense that maybe there's a sort of slight stroppiness and obstinacy on the part of the public, who may be fed up of being called and say, well, you know, I'll tell them completely the opposite from what I'm going to do. I don't know whether that's true. I mean, I think that the primaries and the caucuses in America at this stage of the election are always really very fickle. Because those votes really, you know, it looks as though they matter in one way, but in other ways, if you're going to vote in a primary, in some ways, it really doesn't matter. And we're going to New Hampshire next week. And there, even if you're not a registered party supporter, you can vote in the primary for whichever party. You don't have to be registered. The caucuses in Iowa last week, they're very sort of informal occasion. People were surprised at the big turnout in Iowa last week. So I think there is the general point about polls in the modern world, the difficulty of mobile phones, people getting fed up and all the rest of it. And then there is the particular point about American caucuses and primaries at this stage of the presidential election, that they are just very difficult to call.
But they remain an appealing spectacle, or an unedifying spectacle, depending on your position. What did you make, Daniela, of the actual, what we saw from the likes of Trump? I guess predictably came out and said, well, it's all a fix, and that's why this hasn't reflected the polls. He obviously trusting the polls very much at that particular instance. Did we learn anything about the GOP and whether we can see who might be challenging, Bernie or Hillary? Or do you think, was it just a big sideshow again?
I think it's really far too early to tell. There's just too many people duking it out. And these are important because they're first, they're early. And again, psychologically, it makes a difference. The question of whether people actually will be able to maintain any momentum or much more important at the southern states, that will have much more of an impact on what finally emerges. But this is people are very excited about this whole process because we have some seriously, I was going to say cartoon characters. We have some serious characters. And people have been waiting for this to get going for a long time. And now it is. There's just a fever, an absolute fever, I think, of speculation. It wasn't just Trump who was expressing concerns about what happened in Iowa. But I agree with Mary. It is a very bizarre way of doing things, which is very hard to explain and very hard to imagine and doesn't seem to make much sense, but seems to be the traditional way that these things are done, and so carries on.
It always strikes me as extraordinary that this race can go on for quite literally years. We have a month of very intense campaigning. It's all boiled down usually into that period. But then our pollsters were, if possible, even further off the mark last time around.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's also interesting when you said, well, an American election seems to go on for so long as it does. I mean, in the last 2 years of a two-term president, he's a lame duck and people generally write off his prospects right there. But people predicted that something similar might happen in Britain when the last government introduced fixed-term parliaments. And, there was a lot of sort of weeping and wailing and saying, oh, it'll be just like America, 2 years before, we'll all know the election date and everybody will be gearing up. Well, actually, that's not true. It wasn't true last time, and I don't think it's going to be true this time. The big gamble at the moment in the UK is saying, well, given that Cameron says he's not going to be prime minister after the next election, when is he actually going to resign? That's the big question in people's minds.
Now, very briefly before the end of the show, I want to talk a little bit about punctuation. Purists, especially on the other side of the channel, look away now. The Académie Française might be about to redefine French writing. Outrage amongst the French populace. The spelling of certain words without the circumflex accent would now be included in school books. Sacré bleu, Daniela. What do you make of this? Are you a purist? What side? Are you a sort of, look, let's be realistic, let's just get on with things, or do you think we should respect and uphold the traditional values of the written language?
As an editor, I'm extremely partial to punctuation. Very important. I will share those social media memes. But I think in the case of France, I think the Académie Française has created something of a monster, because this is its own suggestion, and the outrage that has greeted it has been astonishing. And I think the French are famously very protective of their own language, and they've got a reason to, but I think they've turned it into such something so sacred that it's making it quite difficult to progress. And having looked at the details of what's involved, it kind of makes sense. And who on the internet uses one of those funny little hats anymore?
Well, I don't know. What about that? Would you miss the little umbrella, as I always term it, Mary?
Well, I mean, I'm absolutely a purist and a linguistic conservative as well. And I think it's unfortunate to lose these things because, you know, it gives you an idea. It's not just the tradition behind it, but it's also, it shows in a lot of cases the etymology of the word, where it came from and its root. And it says something more than actually just the single word on the page. So I think it will be a loss, but I agree, you know, it's actually not an enormous change. And part of my hostility to this is thinking, all that time that I spent learning how to do this, and I didn't need to do it after.
There we
all.
Go. We must leave it there. Mary Dajewski and Daniela Pellard, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producer, Ben Ryland, and our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. Do join us then. Goodbye.